to Zechariah. Today is Friday, January 20th, and we're on study 18 of our study that we're calling Return from Babylon.
Thank you.
And in the prophet Zechariah, we're in chapter 11, finishing up Zechariah. Chapter 11 is this chapter, as you look at the outline that's coming around here, the chapter 11 is about the rejection of the true shepherd of Israel. The rejection of the true shepherd of Israel. And as we finish chapter 11, which we'll do today, we get in next to the rest of Zechariah, which is the last three chapters, 12, 13, and 14, which is known as the little apocalypse of Zechariah. So we'll probably start chapter 12 today. Chapter 11, could someone get us started today by reading verses 4 through 6?
Thus said the Lord my God, become shepherd of the flock doomed to slaughter. Those who buy them slaughter them and go unpunished, and those who sell them say, blessed be the Lord. I have become rich, and their own shepherds have no pity on them. For I will no longer have pity on the inhabitants of this land, declares the Lord. Behold, I will cause each of them to fall into the hand of his neighbor, and each into the hand of his king. And they shall crush the land, and I will deliver none from their hand.
Okay, great. Thanks, Barry. So when we got together last time and looked at verses 1 through 3, we've described verses 1 through 3 as likely a prophecy of the invasion by Rome of Israel in 70 AD that led to the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. And then we turn now to verse 4, which says, thus says the Lord my God, pasture the flock doomed to slaughter. Wow, that seems like a pretty ominous instruction. Yeah, exactly. So we're looking at this as, we're going to see this chapter as likely a prophecy about the mission and the role of Jesus and his ministry and his rejection. And so this is likely a prophecy of Jesus' ministry of pasturing the nation, or pasturing. He was sent as a shepherd, Messiah to the nation of Israel. But because of his rejection, and we're going to look at these other passages in a second here, because of his rejection by the nation, again, not every Jew, not every member of the nation, but the leadership of the nation, there was a judgment placed on the nation that the flock was doomed to slaughter. And in fact, Jesus having been crucified in, let's call it 30 A.D., he said that within one generation, not one stone will be left upon another, speaking about the judgment on the temple as a result of his rejection. And within a generation, within 40 years, Jerusalem was completely leveled to the ground. About, and secular history tells about this destruction, a guy named Josephus. It's estimated by historians that probably a million Jews were murdered as part of the conquest of Israel and the destruction of Jerusalem. And not only that, probably about 100,000 Jews were sold into slavery by the Roman Empire all over the empire. So this is likely, this verse likely is starting us on this process of describing this flock that Jesus was sent to shepherd that rejected him, that ultimately was doomed for slaughter. Verse 5, those who buy them, slay them. And again, this is likely a prophecy of the slavery of Israel. Again, Rome, not only when they conquered people, they also made money off them by selling them into slavery. And this is likely a prophecy of about 100,000 estimated Jews that were sold into slavery by the Roman Empire. And they go unpunished, those who sell them into slavery. And each of those who sells them says, blessed be the Lord, for I have become rich. And the idea here is that Jews may have been selling out other Jews as part of this judgment and destruction that was likely fulfilled in 70 AD. Verse 5 goes on to say, and their own shepherds have no pity on them. And so the idea here likely is that the very leaders that were entrusted to shepherd the nation of Israel were the ones that rejected the true shepherd. And these are the leaders that basically sold out the flock for power, for their own rich, for their own glory. And that's why the whole flock is doomed to slaughter. Verse 6, for I will, let me just finish this passage and then we'll take, stop for a second. For I will no longer have pity on the inhabitants of the land. But behold, I will cause the men to fall, each to another's power. And so there's this massive judgment that's being described here, and the futility being described for the shepherd who's being told to pasture this flock, whose other shepherds have sold him out, whose other shepherds have really acted in self-interest, and everyone ends up either sold into slavery or dead. Luke.
Is this the first time, because it strikes me weird, is this the first time where leaders are called shepherds? When you think of shepherds, you think of a shepherd.
Yeah.
That kind of throws me. Is there a reason for that?
Yeah. So I don't know if it's the first time, and I don't know about the Hebrew word for shepherd. I know the Greek word for shepherd is poimen, and it's often translated as pastor. But that word poimen actually could mean a guy out in the field with sheep or a leader of a group of people. So, you know, whether this is a shepherd of a flock of sheep or the leader of the people, it's the same idea. You're supposed to be protecting the people you're caring for or the sheep you're caring for.
So they're the corrupt leaders?
Likely. Yeah. Again, I mean, there's people with different ideas on the prophets because, you know, you can kind of... You can make the prophets say whatever you want. You know, we got to be aware of this idea that when we're reading and studying the Bible, a text without a context is a pretext to do whatever you want to do. Okay. And so we got to read all this in context. And as we've been reading in context, it's a lot about Israel and the future of Israel. And we'll see it more so as we go in the future at these passages here. Let's take a look at this next part. Could someone read verses 7 through 11?
I'm sorry, before you go there, what year did you say this was, Zechariah? This
is 520, so this is about 500 years before Jesus is born. This prophecy is given. This is 520 BC. Remember, Zechariah and Haggai were both raised up by Yahweh to go to the land of Israel, to Jerusalem, to Israel who had left Babylon to come to rebuild the temple. And he's raised these prophets up. First and foremost, to tell the people in of the nation of Israel, they got to start rebuilding the temple again.
Right.
Yeah. But after that primary message, you get all this other information from the prophets about the future of the nation. Could someone read verses 7 through 11?
So I pastured the flock, doomed to slaughter, hence the afflicted of the flock, and I took for myself two staffs. The one I called favor, and the other I called union. So I pastured the flock. Then I annihilated the three shepherds in 1 month. And my soul was impatient with them, and their soul also was weary of me. Then I said, I will not pasture you. What is to die, let it die. And what is to be annihilated, let it be annihilated. And let those who are flesh, I'm sorry, those who are left, eat one another's flesh. I took my staff favor and cut it in pieces to break my covenant, which I made with all the peoples. So it was broken on that day, and thus the afflicted of the flock who were watching me realized that it was the word of the Lord.
Okay, great. Thanks, Lou. So again, we're looking at this passage as a rejection of the true shepherd. And what we likely have here in verse 7, so I pastured the flock doomed for slaughter. Again, you compare that with the prior verse 4, the Lord declaring, pasture the flock doomed to slaughter. This is an instruction to Jesus. You have Jesus fulfilling the command. He actually comes into the world to fulfill his role. He preaches the gospel of the kingdom. The gospel of Jesus Christ is that the nation should repent so that the messianic kingdom can enter in, can come forth. And he pastures this flock. He is obedient to this role, yet it is doomed to slaughter. And hence the afflicted of the flock. The idea here likely might be that although Jesus came for the whole nation of Israel, he especially came to shepherd the afflicted of Israel. And that made, you know, you think he preached to the blind, the deaf, the downcast, but also think about the faithful remnant. Some Jews did believe him. Mm-hmm. Actually, not some, a lot did. A lot received his message. A lot repented. It was the leadership of the nation that gave him the middle finger. And so it's likely that the afflicted of the flock are the remnant, those members of the nation of Israel that did believe, that did receive, that did accept the afflicted. And it says here, I took for myself, this would be Jesus again, two staffs, prophetically speaking, one called favor and the other called union. So I pastured the flock. And the idea, again, Jesus came for Israel. The staff favor, the staff union. Well, what could these be? I think likely the staff favor is, think about when Jesus came with his gospel. The gospel for Israel, if that nation repents, the kingdom will enter in. Remember, John the Baptist was told, this is the favorable year of the Lord. And so the idea of the staff of favor being the favor of Israel. Israel is to, the Messiah is here. Israel is to go forth and enter the kingdom. This is the staff that Messiah had. What about the staff of union? What does that mean? Well, if you can recall, at this point in time in 520 BC, the northern kingdom, the 10 tribes, have been dispersed into the nations 200 years earlier by the Empire of Assyria. And really, most of the returnees from Babylon that have come to Jerusalem are basically members mostly of the tribe of Judah. And so the idea of the staff of union is not only when the Messianic kingdom is ushered in, but the promises the Messiah has made to the nation are fulfilled too. The return of all Israel to the land to enjoy the kingdom. So the idea of the staff of union is likely when the Messiah ushers in the Messianic kingdom, all Israel will be back in the land, not just the tribe of Judah, but even these other tribes that have been dispersed into the nations, a union of Israel again. And verse 8, then I annihilated the three shepherds in 1 month, for my soul was impatient with them, and their soul also was weary with of me. Now, wow, what the heck is that? And again, you know, you read three commentators, you're going to get six different opinions. But it is very likely that, remember, and we'll talk about this in a second, one of the consequences of the national rejection of the messiahship of Yeshua by the nation of Israel was the judgment of destruction, fulfilled in 70 AD. And so we're going to come to this passage in the Gospels that talks about this a little bit, but the idea is once the nation made its decision, once the leadership of the nation made its decision, you're not the guy, Jesus basically said, now you're going to have to eat the fruit of your decision. And the fruit of that decision was literally the nation was destroyed within a generation. And when you talk about, then I annihilated three shepherds in 1 month, the leadership of the nation disappeared too. These worthless shepherds, gone. Well, who are these three shepherds? Well, here are some of the candidates. Sadducees, Pharisees, and scribes, gone. Other candidates, priests, elders, and scribes. The idea is the leadership of this nation that made this bad decision is literally annihilated. Well, what's 1 month? It's hard to say. But 70 AD, you know, basically August of 70 AD, Jerusalem was gone. Really didn't. The temple's gone. Every building's destroyed. After everyone has spent the period of siege eating each other within the walls, when the Romans get in, and they've killed everyone. So maybe that is what the prophecy is about. It's very possible. And then verse 9, check this out. Then I said to you, I will not pasture you. What is to die, let it die. What is to be annihilated, let it be annihilated. And those who are left to eat one another's flesh. The idea is after the rejection, this is, you made the decision, here's the consequence. And, you know, it's interesting, but this text being written and brought forth by Isaiah 500 years before it, Josephus, tells us that literally people were eating, cannibalism was rampant in Jerusalem as the Romans surrounded the city. I mean, there's no water, no food. They were trying to keep them out. And so people, mothers were eating their babies, boiling their children to eat. So this literally was going on. Verse 10, I took my staff favor. And what does Jesus do if this is Jesus? Cuts it in pieces. The favor of the nation is gone. To break my covenant, which I made with the peoples. What's this covenant that's being discussed? Well, it's probably not the Abrahamic covenant or the Davidic covenant or the land covenant or the Mosaic covenant or the new covenant, because all those covenants are made between Yahweh and the nation of Israel. This is a covenant that's been made with the Gentiles, the peoples. And so, again, there's a lot of deliberation of what is this covenant that gets broken? It's very likely that this covenant is a covenant with the Gentiles, that the protection of Israel was always guaranteed to a great degree by Yahweh, basically until the rejection of the Messiah, and in which case that protection or this covenant with the Gentiles, that their hands were off of Israel, was broken, and now Gentiles can just give the beat down to Israel. And we'll look at a text in the New Testament that seems to indicate that that's what Zechariah is probably getting at. What I want to do now is I want to look at this idea. What is it that, if this is Jesus speaking prophetically and saying very mean statements, you know, from the snowflake standard, these are mean, you know, let them be annihilated. Let's take a look at maybe what's going on here in Matthew chapter 12.
This point, Chris, are there more Hebrew Christians or more Gentile Christians?
In Zechariah or Matthew?
Well, wherever you were when you just left off there.
Jesus Christ hasn't been born yet, so there are no Christians.
Oh. Am I thinking?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah. So Matthew chapter 12.
Wait. When they rejected Jesus, he had been born.
Yeah, so Zechariah gives this in 520 BC. It was a prophecy about the future.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah. Now, for us, it's already taken place. Yeah. But for them, it was still a prophecy of the future.
Okay,
yeah.
I got you.
Yeah. So in Matthew chapter 12, so you're going to have, for those of you in this study, if you go back to our Life of Christ study about 4 years ago in the blog, you may remember some of our discussion of this. And by the way, we're repeating that study for those of you who are in our Monday class after we finish Isaiah. But if you can remember from our study of the life of Messiah a couple of number of years ago, we talked about the fact that the first half of Jesus' ministry was preaching the gospel to the nation, repent, so that the kingdom could begin. And we saw that as part of that ministry, the leadership of the nation was following Jesus basically wherever he went. Mm-hmm. Folks from Jerusalem were following him all around. And it's because, you know, in that time period, it's not like Jesus was the only guy that showed up to claim to be the Messiah. I mean, a lot of people did. A lot of people do today. Still going on today. But the leadership of the nation always had some kind of obligation to inquire what's going on here, because Jesus was attracting a lot of followers. And so as we read the Gospels, we saw that the scribes and the priests and the Pharisees being sent from Jerusalem, from the leadership of Jerusalem, were always sent to ask Jesus a lot of questions, like, what are you doing? Why are you doing it? So there was a period of evaluation. There was a period of interrogation. And there ultimately had to come a time after the leadership spent all of this time evaluating what the claims, that there ultimately had to be a decision that had to be made. Now, what was different, the thing that was different about Jesus from all the other guys that said, I'm the Messiah, was that Jesus didn't just say he was the Messiah, but he also would do something very unusual, which most folks couldn't do. He was able to authenticate those claims by supernatural evidence of miraculous events. He was able to heal people, cause the weather to change, raise the dead. He was able to do things that other people that claimed him the Messiah just couldn't do. And so the folks started to realize, wait a second, this guy has got to be the real deal. He's not only just saying it, but he's doing things that authenticate the message. And so in Matthew chapter 12, we come to the point of decision for the nation. Verse 22. Jesus is in Galilee here. Verse 22 says, then a demon-possessed man who was blind and mute was brought to Jesus, and he healed him, so that the mute man spoke and saw. Now, by the way, by this time, Jesus had done a lot of miracles, a lot. And this might seem to you like this is no big deal, especially compared to all the other stuff he's done. But in the time of Yeshua's ministry, there were basically three specific miracles that the rabbis and the leadership had been teaching that only Messiah could do. In fact, they were sign miracles. You know, we'll know the Messiah once he's able to perform these specific signs. One of the signs that the rabbis taught that only Messiah could do was the supernatural miracle of healing a mute person. You might think that seems really weird and stupid. What's so messianic about that? Well, believe it or not, Jesus wasn't only the only person involved in casting out demons back in the day. There were a lot of rabbis that had the ability to cast out demons. In fact, you'll read it later in Acts, there was one of these Jewish guys running around in Greece that was casting out demons. He didn't even know who Jesus was. But there was a specific procedure that the rabbis would use in casting out demons. And the specific procedure employed was that you couldn't cast a demon out of a person unless that demon identified itself. And then you would take authority over the demon to bring it forth. If you can remember, there's one of the miracles where the demon identifies. Jesus engages in this procedure a lot. He says, identify yourselves. They say, we are legion. And then he, after identifying the demon, he uses that. Well, a mute person there was no way to identify the demon. And so that way, this teaching had arisen that, you know, if someone can heal a mute guy, because you can't follow the basic rabbinic procedure for exorcism, that's a messianic miracle. Well, you might come across as kind of read past it. It's no big deal. And it does seem like no big deal, except for verse 23. Verse 23, there's a major disclosure here that indicates this is a big deal.
The people recognize
it. Yeah, what about verse 23 that tell you that this is a big deal?
Son of David. Perhaps.
Yeah, the people react to this miracle specifically. They say, and not just a couple of folks, all the crowd saw this and they were amazed, flabbergasted in English. And after seeing this, they ask a logical question. What do they ask?
Who is this guy?
Not just who is this guy.
Is this guy the Christ?
Is this Christ guy the Messiah? That's the son of David is the promised king of Israel. And by the way, they're asking, the people that they're asking are the Pharisees who they noticed have come to Galilee from Jerusalem.
Who've been teaching them this.
That's exactly right. They know they're right there and they saw the same thing. And they say, is this him? Now they're demanding an answer from their leadership. You've told us that this is that we saw it. You saw it too. Now the question, is this the Messiah? So again, we're halfway through his ministry by this time. And leadership has had plenty of time to figure this out.
Right.
And again, remember, think about Zechariah. Zechariah is pissed off at the worthless shepherds.
Mm-hmm.
And he's going to annihilate the worthless shepherds. So we want to get a handle down on how are the shepherds of the nation we're going to respond to this question. Verse 24. But when the Pharisees, these are the folks that had come down from Jerusalem, heard this, they pronounce their official decision from on high. And in answer to the question of the leadership, this is really the first time the decision is announced. What is the decision that Jerusalem makes about these claims after 1.5 years?
Well, they rejected him because they said that he was really the devil.
Yeah.
And
But 25 and 26, I mean, that just blows that theory away.
Yeah, so take a look at verse 24. So think about it. The nation, and when I say the nation, I'm talking about every perpetrator in the nation, in fact, the leadership of the nation. You know, Bray, you guys made a deal with Iran. I didn't make a deal with Iran. Obama made a deal with Iran. I didn't make it, but guess what? I'm stuck in a country with really crappy leadership. And again, you know, you got people, good people in the station, but the leaders have made a bad decision. They had one choice. They had two decisions they could have made. One is, when the question was posed, is this the Messiah? What are the two decisions they could have made?
They could have said
yes. Yes, they could have said, yeah, you know, we got it. The evidence is there.
Yeah.
But instead, they said no. Now, what's the problem? If they say no, what's the problem they're going to have to deal with?
No more cash flow.
Okay, that's good. But what's the more immediate problem in terms of they've been teaching everyone that only what they saw the Messiah could do, and he just did it. They're going to have to explain that, aren't they?
Yeah.
So how do so they can't deny the supernatural activity. So how do they deny that Jesus is the Messiah if he's been doing this supernatural activity?
That could do it, right? The Christ and Antichrist.
Verse 24. He does have the power. It comes from a Satan.
Yep.
So this is the official decision of the rejection of the Messiah. Take a look at verse 25. And so that's it. That is it. I mean, they've had a long time. And by the way, well, let's not go there. Let me just continue on. We're there, and he knows they've had the time, and now that they've made the decision, now comes the judgment. And by the way, the judgment is irrevocable. It can't be changed. And it's a national judgment. It's not a personal judgment. It's not judging the souls of men. It's the judgment on this nation that is now fixed and irreversible. It's the judgment of 70 AD. Verse 25. Jesus, knowing their thoughts, says, can a kingdom divided against itself laid waste, or a city divided against itself stand? In other words, Satan would be attacking this. I've been attacking satanic problems for 1.5 years. Why would Satan be attacking himself? Verse 26. Mm-hmm. If Satan casts out Satan, he is standing against himself. He's basically explaining, I've been acting against Satan. You've all seen it. Now, verse 27, if I by Beelzebub cast out demons, by whom do your sons cast them out? So what's Jesus saying there?
Are you doing the same thing?
Yeah. And by the way, I just told you, right? The rabbis were casting out demons.
Right.
Everyone knows that.
Right.
So he's saying, if I'm doing it by Satan, maybe you guys are too. That's exactly right. Now, for this reason, they will be your judges. Verse 28, but if I cast out, now listen, if you're wrong, and this activity is by the Spirit of God, then that solidifies your wrong decision, because if I'm doing this by God, according to your teaching, I am Messiah.
Right.
And hence, the kingdom has come upon you. The idea is the kingdom was right here. And if I really was of the Lord, the kingdom would have come straight on. The Messianic kingdom would have started right up. Verse 29. And he goes on about, you know, how can someone, you know, how can a bad guy take on another bad guy? And then check out verse 31. Therefore, I say to you, and he's speaking to the Pharisees, any sin and blasphemy will be forgiven people, but blasphemy against the Spirit shall not be forgiven. Now again, we're talking about a lot of believers that get afraid about this verse. This verse is not for the believer. There's no sin that a believer that can commit that it cannot be forgiven as long as they repent. But this nation, Jesus isn't dead. Jesus hasn't given up his life yet. There's been no atonement for sin yet. He's still alive. Jesus says here that this sin, what sin? The rejection of the Messiah by the nation constitutes blasphemy of the Holy Spirit, and it can't be forgiven. And it won't be forgiven. Judgment is fixed. The nation will be destroyed literally within a generation. And so Jesus talks a lot about this judgment that's coming after this turning point in his ministry. A couple other verses let's look at. And there's some other ideas that you can even lay a hold of in terms of Jesus would maybe say something like this to someone. You know, look, you're toast. I'm done with you. Take a look at Matthew chapter 7.
I'm sorry?
Let's take a look at another verses that kind of have the same type of ideas. Matthew chapter 7. And when I say the same type of ideas, the same types of ideas of this prophecy in Zechariah, where you got this righteous shepherd that's finally done with the flock and says, let him be annihilated. I'm handing him over. In Matthew chapter 7, this is Jesus. Could someone read verse 6?
Don't give what is holy to dogs or toss your pearls before pigs, or they will trample them with their feet, turn, and tear you to pieces.
Yeah, the idea here is that, you know, sometimes, let me call it this, you got to detach with love. You know, sometimes you spend a lot of time trying to reach people or help them or share the gospel with them, and there's only so much rejection that can occur until you just got to hand them over to the Lord. And sometimes part of that handing over is a whoop, is a serious whoop. I used to go to an all-black church for a number of years, and I love what our pastor used to teach. You know, and this is true today. You know, sometimes, you know, you just got to hand other brothers. I've talked to a lot of brothers that find girlfriends, you know, and they want to, you know, leave their wives to marry their girlfriends. And they're like, wait, you know, all kinds of nonsense. And every once in a while, you know, you just try to counsel them long enough that you just got to let go.
Yep.
And you got to let God deal with them. And Hebrews tells us it's a terrible thing to fall into the hands of the living God. So Pastor Joey, I love what he used to say. He used to say, look, if the Lord's getting ready to lay a whoop on someone, don't get in the middle of it unless you want a piece of it.
Yeah.
Just let go. And this is kind of an evidence of that. Turn to Luke chapter 9. This is Jesus, and he asks someone, and he makes a request, and he gets turned down. Jesus, Luke chapter 9, verse 59. Actually, look at verse 57. As they were going along the road, someone said to him, I will follow you wherever you go. And Jesus said to him, hey, look, the foxes have holes and the birds have nests, but you know, I got nowhere to lay my head, so make sure you know what you're asking for. And then verse 59, he said to another, he walks to another guy, follow me. But the guy he asked said, Lord, permit me first to go and bury my father. I want you to focus on verse 60. But he said to him, let the dead bury their own dead. And sometimes that's a message to us. Sometimes you can only teach and persuade and pray for, and sometimes you just gotta let go and let the dead bury their own dead and move on. Wipe the dust off your feet. So coming back to, let's come back to Zechariah chapter 11. You can kind of see these very hard statements in Zechariah.
I'm curious if his father was actually dead yet.
That's a good question.
I'm just gonna go back and wait. Get the inheritance, and then okay.
Yeah, that could be. But coming back to Zechariah chapter 11, when you see these things, like in verse 9, then I said, I will not pasture you. What is to die, let it die. What is to be annihilated, let it be annihilated. You know, then you can see that after the rejection by the nation, he basically hands the nation over to their ultimate annihilation, basically in 70 AD. So let's take a look at verses. Could someone read verses 12 through 14 in Zechariah 11?
Then I said to them, if it seems right to you, give me my wages, but if not, keep them. So they weighed my wages, 30 pieces of silver. Throw it to the potter. The Lord said to me, this magnificent price I was valued by them. So I took the 30 pieces of silver and threw it into the house of the Lord to the potter. Then I cut into my second staff union, annulling the brotherhood between Judah and Israel.
Okay, great. Thank you, Ryan. So now you have in verse 12, I said to them, this is the good shepherd who was sent to pasture the sheep doomed to slaughter, saying to them, this is likely him saying to the shepherds, the worthless shepherds that get annihilated. So he says this to these worthless shepherds. If it's good in your sight, pay me what you think I'm worth. If not, just forget it. And if he is speaking, if this is Jesus speaking to these worthless shepherds, what do they pay him?
Slave wage.
Yeah, what exactly do they pay him?
30 pieces of silver.
That sound familiar to
him? Yeah.
Okay, so hold on a second. Yeah. So first of all, what is the significance of 30 pieces of silver? And Paul, I'm going to have Paul answer. But before we have Paul answer, I want you all to see this. Go to Exodus chapter 21. So this is part of the law of Moses. This is part of Torah, one of the 613 commandments that Israel was bound by until the law was fulfilled. And under Exodus chapter 21, could someone read verse 32?
If the ox scores a slave, male or female, the owner shall give to their master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned.
Yeah, you know, check this out. You know, if so part of the law of Moses requires, look, if you have one of your slaves killed by another man's ox, you've got to be compensated for that dead slave. What's the required compensation for a dead slave?
30 pieces of silver.
This is exactly how the worthless shepherds of Israel valued the true shepherd.
Wow.
Like a dead slave. Now let's go to Matthew chapter 26. This is Zechariah. Now remember, speaking 500 years before Jesus was born. Let's see how Matthew plays this out.
Matthew 26.
Oh, yeah, Matthew 26, please. And Lou, when you get there, would you mind reading verses 14 through 16?
Then one of the 12 names, Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and said, what are you going to give me to betray him to you? And they weighed him out 30 pieces of silver to him. From then on, he began looking for a good opportunity to betray Jesus.
So the chief priests, the leadership of the nation, the same folks that made the bad decision about his claims of being Messiah, what do they pay Judas?
30 pieces.
Price of a dead slave. So this is all good evidence that Zechariah is talking about Jesus when we read these passages. Come back to Zechariah chapter 11, and we'll finish chapter 11 here. Could someone read verses 15 through 17?
Then the Lord said to me, take again the equipment of a foolish shepherd, for I am going to raise up a shepherd over the land who will not care for the lost and seek the young or heal the injured or feed the healthy, but will eat the meat of the choice sheep, tearing off their hooves. Woe to the worthless shepherd who deserts the flock. May the sword strike his arm and his right eye. May his arm be completely withered, his right eye totally blind.
Okay, yeah, thank you, Rick. Appreciate that. So, again, you've got, this is likely, the Lord said to me, Jesus, likely, take again for yourself the equipment of a foolish shepherd. For behold, I'm going to raise up a shepherd in the land who will not care for the perishing. The idea may be here that once the nation makes its decision on a national level, they're going to reject the Messiah, then just let it go. And let these worthless shepherds rise up to the position and do what they're going to do. And by the way, if you remember from our study of the life of Jesus, his ministry does change materially after the rejection. Before the rejection, his ministry is very much about preaching the gospel. The kingdom's here. The nation has to repent. I'm the Messiah. As soon as he's rejected, he no longer preaches that. And he begins to speak secretly, only to his disciples, and in a form of teaching we call parables. Stuff that no one gets until there's a private explanation. And it goes on here that, woe to the worthless shepherd who leaves the flock. There's judgment on this worthless shepherd. And this is likely the judgment that is mentioned earlier in Zechariah 11. They're going to get annihilated, these worthless shepherds. And again, if you look at history, from Zechariah's point, it was future. From our point, it's past. 70 AD, these guys disappeared.
Chris, just to go back for a second, the three miracles that only Messiah could do, the supernatural healing of the mute person, are we going to learn the other two as we go?
Man, that is a great question, Ryan. That is a really good question. And in Monday's class, we will learn those. But let me just give you a hint real quick. One of the other miracles, so the three were raising of the dead, healing of a mute demon-possessed man, and the other one was healing a Jewish man of leprosy. No other Jew had ever done that. Now, Naaman was healed of leprosy, but Naaman was a Gentile. There are three chapters in the law having to deal with healing of leprosy. There's no documented evidence of it ever having been done, except for Jesus the Messiah.
Thank you.
Yeah. So let's take a look now. That finishes chapter 11. So now we're going on to chapter 12. And so these three chapters, just to lay the framework here, are what are often called by commentators the little apocalypse of Zechariah. The little apocalypse of Zechariah. Well, why did... That means nothing to me. What does that mean, little apocalypse? Why it's often called the little apocalypse of Zechariah is because in these three chapters, you basically get the framework of what is later disclosed in the entire book of Revelation. And by the way, the book of Revelation, the Greek word translated Revelation is apokalypsis, which could also be translated as the apocalypse. So actually before 100 years ago, it used to be translated into English, the apocalypse of Jesus Christ is the last book of the Bible. So this is called the little apocalypse of Zechariah because, again, in these three chapters, you're getting a framework of what gets totally mapped out in the 22 chapters of Revelation. This is a prophecy of the very end. So let's begin with chapter 12. And again, we're talking about 520 years before Jesus is born. This is announced. So at verses 1, chapter 12, could someone read verses 1 through 3?
This is the word of the Lord concerning Israel. The Lord who stretches out the heaven, who lays the foundation of the earth, and who formed the spirit of man within him, declare, I am the one to make Jerusalem a cup that sends all the surrounding people reeling. Judah will be besieged as well as Jerusalem. On that day when all the nations of the earth are gathered against her, I will make Jerusalem an immovable rock for all the nations. All who try to move it will injure themselves.
Good. Perfect. Thank you, Carl. So what does verse 1 tell us about what Zechariah is about to say? Or what is verse 1 described as?
Oracle.
An oracle. What's another word for oracle?
Premonition.
Yeah. What's another word for premonition?
Prophecy.
A prophecy. This is a prophecy. About what? Verse 1.
Concerning Israel.
A prophecy about Israel. Listen up. Behold, verse 2. What's going to happen as part of this prophecy?
Specifically talks about Jerusalem. The
Jerusalem,
city.
Good. What about Jerusalem in this prophecy?
Siege.
People are going to come against it, but for no reason, to no avail.
Who's going to come against it?
The nations, the peoples around.
Yeah. All the Gentiles are going to come against Jerusalem. All the Gentiles are going to come up against Jerusalem. Good, good, good. That's a prophecy. Now, what's going to happen to these Gentiles that come up against Jerusalem according to this prophecy from Yahweh? Serious problems. Yeah. Specifically, verse 3. Yeah. It will come about in that day, I will make Jerusalem a heavy stone for these folks. The folks who try to lift it, what's going to happen to them?
Severely.
They're going to be severely... They're going to come up to attack it. whoa, they're going to be cast back. And all the nations of the earth are going to be gathered against Jerusalem.
Is that the day of the Lord?
Yes. 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 There's a time coming, brothers. There's a time coming when Israel will stand. Well, already right now, basically. Israel will stand alone. That's basically right now. But there's even a greater time of distress for Israel coming. Every nation will be gathered against it to destroy it. And Yahweh is going to turn this thing around and send these nations back reeling as these nations drink of what they think is a bowl of victory becomes a cup of wrath.
Well, so, we kind of see this in the making right now.
Yeah, I mean, right, we're getting close.
We're talking of draining the swamp, or, you know, just that.
Yeah, there you go.
No, it's just over and over and over again. God's whole manual, his whole Bible, obedience, blessings, disobedience, wrath. And prophecy, he calls it prophecy. Well, foretelling, here's what's coming.
And that.
And so many times we just won't believe it. We take the suffering, take being beat up and butchered up, yet we keep going our stupid way.
Yeah, sure. Sure.
Yeah, that won't change, right?
Is the Hebrew here indicating all the nations will be actively pursuing Jerusalem?
Or representatives of such. In other words, every national, yeah, basically, it's not that there won't be people that will be righteous and will
right.
be against it.
Right.
But it's kind of like the United States. The United States, again, right now, is against, with the current administration, is
right.
against Israel.
Right.
I'm not against Israel. Right. Same idea here.
But are there nations that are going to like, well, we're not for Israel, but we're not against Israel. Well, if you're not for me, you're against me.
Yeah, I don't know.
Maybe
that's a good, That could be. I just think, and we'll look at Revelation 19 and probably next Friday, but we'll see it really is a cataclysmic. It's almost like there's no hope.
It's a good point you've made. You're not against it.
No.
But our leader.
Our leaders are.
He's almost.
Our leader. I don't know about the incoming administration, but the outgoing administration is against Israel. And because he's a leader, he stands for this country, and therefore America is against Israel.
Exactly.
And you know what? I think we're going to end up with problems for that stance.
Yes.
I'm going to probably suffer as a result of that, even though I don't have anything to do with it.
I really believe, though, and just my opinion, you see, your leader, whom you didn't, I'm sure, vote for to start with, was against them. All nations coming against Israel, God will, he will move his mighty hand, and he will give them a blow that they're not going to like. Well, but there's forgiveness, and look how many people now have voted to stop that evil ruler from staying against Israel. And it's my belief, and I believe with all my heart, we're going to see a huge change from him within the United States coming for Israel's defense.
I hope you're right, Carl. I hope you're right.
I believe that totally.
Let's finish one more passage, and then we'll move on. Could someone read verses 4 through 9?
In that day, declares the Lord, I will strike every horse with bewilderment and his rider with madness, but I will watch over the house of Judah while I strike every horse of the peoples with blindness. Then the clans of Judah will stay in their hearts. A strong support for us are the inhabitants of Jerusalem through the Lord of hosts, their God. In that day, I will make the clans of Judah like a firepot among pieces of wood, and a flaming torch among sheaves, so they will consume on the right hand and on the left all the surrounding peoples, while the inhabitants of Jerusalem again dwell on their own sites in Jerusalem. The Lord also will save the tents of Judah first, so that the glory of the house of David and the glory of the inhabitants of Jerusalem will not be magnified above Judah. In that day, the Lord will defend the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and the one who is feeble among them in that day will be like David. Yikes. I'm so sorry.
Don't worry about it.
Oh, gosh. And that was Pastor Hayes. Oh, God. Oh, geez. The house of David will be like God, like the angel of the Lord before them. And in that day, I will set about to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem.
Okay, great. So thanks, Lou. So we got 2 minutes, so let's just finish this up quickly. Remember, verse 1 tells us this is a prophecy about Israel. There's a day coming when all nations are going to gather against this city. And here's what we're told in verse 4. In that day, I'm going to strike every weapon of war with bewilderment and the operator of that weapon with madness. I'm going to watch over this nation. And specifically, I want you to focus on verse 8. In that day, when this happens, verse 8, the Lord will defend Jerusalem. And even the weak among that city are going to be like David, an ass kicker in the name of Yahweh. And the house of David, Israel, will be like God, like the angel of Yahweh before them. And verse 9, what is the fate of these nations that try to destroy Jerusalem in the future? Toast. Next Friday, we're going to read Revelation 19 and see how this is fulfilled in Revelation. And with that, we'll close.